What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Jimbo is the author of the brand new book, Orange Coin Good, The Value of Bitcoin, Book One. It's not too late to help your pre-coiner friends and loved ones grok the value of Bitcoin. Help them understand questions and answer questions like, why do we need Bitcoin? How does it work for you? What does Bitcoin achieve? These answers and more in Orange Coin Good. Welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast, Jimbo. How are you?
I'm doing quite well, thanks. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, man, this is awesome. Kind of like what we were just jamming about before. You know, first of all, I love the book. I read a lot of kind of books geared towards pre-coiners, and I'm just continuously amazed, and I was definitely in this situation, that how much they each bring to the table. This one, you know, just kind of hit me like it's just, I think it's the perfect book for someone like me if I was coming to Bitcoin right now. It really threads that needle of explaining things well. I love the framework around more social, monetary, and technology from kind of like that pre-coiner perspective. And the way you kind of lace in different examples is fantastic. And what I also really dig, and I don't know when, which came first. I definitely saw you on Twitter, I think, before the book. So I love your tweets. I think they're fantastic from all different angles. So I can't wait to get into it. You know, my first question is, why did you write this book?
Well, first, let me say thank you so much for having me. And those are very kind words. I'm glad you liked the book. How did I start writing it? The really short answer, I guess, would be that in 2017, when I fell into the rabbit hole, I started learning a lot. And I wanted to explain that to some of my pre-coiner friends. And so I started writing what I thought was going to be a newsletter. And I just kept finding more stuff. And I would try to reference things I didn't understand. So it became longer and longer. And I around 2018, I decided to make it into a book. That got longer and longer. And then once I kind of knew what shape the book was going to take, I realized that it was going to be 600 pages. And nobody wants to read a 600 page book. So I reorganized it to be four books, each of which are about 150 pages. And then Orange Coin Good is the first of a four book series. And that's as far as I got.
Wow. So are the other books already written to be released?
They're not completed. They're in various stages of completeness.
Wow. That's interesting. That's really interesting. It took you about a little more than a year to write the book? Or books, I should say, wherever they are now in the form, including releasing this one?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I've been writing on and off since, like I said, around 2017. The book in its current form, Orange Coin Good, hasn't really changed much in probably 8 or 9 months, probably since early 2020 was kind of done. But like I said, I have maybe half of the content for another book or two already written.
And how long has the book been out? It released late last year, right? Like October 26th, I think?
Yeah. So it went on October 31st on White Paper Day.
Okay, awesome.
Yeah.
And what's the reaction like been to the book so far?
I don't know, kind of tepid. I haven't really done a lot of serious marketing. Mostly it's been kind of the Bitcoin plebs, and I do pronounce it that way, despite some controversy over that.
I do too.
Yeah, I pronounce words the way they
I go back and forth, to be honest. I'm not, but that's the one I lean at most.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of a personal failing of mine, is that I go back and forth about how much to self-promote, and it's difficult, you know, it's difficult to be out there selling. So I think my book's pretty excellent, but I still have trouble like going out and selling it, you know, salesperson style.
I understand. And it's kind of like taking on a whole new enchilada of endeavors. You know, maybe I'm assuming this is your first book, period. And then you have to learn everything that goes along with the book from A to Z of marketing and everything else goes into it. That's really interesting. I got to say before, I love the book. I think it's going to catch kind of like on fire. I think it's definitely the book that I would hand out to people as a primer. It is. I already have two copies. I plan to give out at least one shortly, and I'll get more. So let's jump into it a little bit. You know, it seems not only, I really like the way you distill a lot of things in the book. And to me, it seems like I was assuming that you've kind of been in the Bitcoin space a lot longer than even 2017, from the way you were able to distill a lot of, not just information, but then kind of like into new analogies and really chisel them. And what I also gather from your presence on Twitter is that you kind of have a good understanding for the community. And so I think one of the first things you kind of kick off is like with like the Bitcoin community is don't trust verify. So kind of what do you mean by that?
Yeah, the meme don't trust verify means that whereas the legacy system is all about trusting somebody else, right? So when you have a bank account, you're trusting that the bank has your money. Bitcoin is all about doing it yourself. So you run your own node, you verify the addresses yourself. It's all about taking into your own control verification of any information that's out there, as opposed to just taking it on good faith.
Mm. I love the way you kind of like just some of your alliteration. So like what is green paper and why is it bad?
Yeah. So great question. Fantastic question. Thank you for asking. So the book has gone through a number of iterations, and I've asked a large number of people to take a look at and provide feedback. Some of those people were pre-coiners, people who were not yet into Bitcoin, and they provided a lot of good feedback. One of the pieces of feedback that I got from a fellow Bitcoin pleb named Saint Bitcoin, he said that really what I should do at the beginning of the book, because that didn't used to be chapter one. Chapter one is called Green Paper Bad, and it describes the reasons why fiat currency are not good for you. And I tried to do that in a way that didn't overwhelm the reader with too much financial history, financial theory. But the first chapter is Green Paper Bad and talks all about the ways in which fiat currency is bad for you. And the reason I added that chapter was in response to Saint Bitcoin's recommendation that I needed to basically convince the reader that there's a problem that they need to solve.
Right, right. Yeah, I think it always goes back to that whole, you know, I get accosted a lot where people want to know what is Bitcoin, and they don't really give me a lot of the patience I feel needed for me to then turn around about what is money and what is the US dollar and how does that work. One of the really interesting examples that you brought up, like, can you kind of like expand on like inflation versus tax rate and kind of which does more damage if you stipulate a 2% inflation, which for this conversation, we will stipulate the 2% CPI index or whatever it is.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So the gist of what you're asking about is in the first couple pages of the book, the very first thing that I point out is that if you consider the devaluation of the currency on a year-to-year basis by 2%, which is what the central bank claims is its target. Mm-hmm. And I say the central bank, I mean here the Fed and the ECB. Different central banks have different targets at different times. But generally speaking, everybody has kind of rallied around this 2% target. If you have 2% inflation year over year over year, from the time that you start working till the time you finish working over a 40-year lifespan, you'll end up losing roughly 55% of your total purchasing power. So I compare that to a hypothetical 20% tax rate. I picked 20% because if you look at historical rates in the United States, tax rate as a percentage, tax take as a percentage of GDP, what you find is that it's always right around 20%. It's maybe a little bit higher, a little bit lower, irrespective of whatever the top tax rate is. So even in the middle of the 20th century, around the 1950s, when the top tax rate was say 90%, the tax take as a fraction of overall GDP was still right around 20%. That doesn't seem to change much. So I used 20% as kind of a fixed marker for that reason. I believe I made reference to that in the citations, the notes and references, which I'm told nobody ever reads. So
right. Yeah, I mean, after 40 years of working, your inflation loss is equivalent to a 55% tax rate, which is kind of how you laid out that argument, which was it's kind of astounding how much of your wealth or your value just you don't get to keep. Another thing you mentioned fractions just there, and kind of like how do you look at price, you know, maybe as a fraction?
That's a great question. So one thing that I learned quickly when I was falling into the rabbit hole in 2017 was the price of something is what you give up to acquire it. Right. So if you earn fiat currency for your job, then fiat currency is what you give up to get Bitcoin. And so then the price is that ratio. It's you divide whatever the good is that you're trying to get by the cost, right? That's the ratio. I just realized you're referring to the big fraction in that chapter. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you just take, you know, price equals goods divided by money. So a typical use case for a person at a store would be you're trying to buy apples and there's some sort of apple unit price, which is like 20 cents per apple. Then if you spend a dollar, you get five of them. So you take five divided by, you know, $1 and you get whatever, 20 cents or maybe backwards. I'm thinking off trying to do math in my head and failing to do so.
No worries.
No, but so price is just a ratio of goods to money. And so if prices right. are going to go up, that means that either the goods that are available to you go down or the money that is chasing them goes up. And that's kind of the natural way that one could try to create inflation. So in the context of central banks trying to create inflation, if they were genuine in their desire to make prices increase, then they could either try to decrease the amount of goods that you get, or they could try to increase the amount of money chasing those same goods. They don't really have a lot of opportunity to do the former. And so they focus on the latter, increasing the money supply.
Right. And how does money really enter the system then?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the central bank is the origin effectively of all money in the system. You could make an argument that bank credit is also money, and that's the definition that a lot of people use. They're different measures of the money supply. But in effect, money comes into existence when the central bank spends it into existence in exchange for bonds. I mean, I could go into more detail on that. You're kind of catching me off guard with,
no
with monetary policy questions, which I didn't study for before the test.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting though. It's like, I think that, you know, it's like, I what if I'm cool with inflation because my salary goes up, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5% a year, maybe even 10% a year. I mean, how am I really getting a raw deal?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in the book, I address that concern. When one of the people who reviewed my book quite a bit was my dad. And one of the things that he pointed out was that when he was trying to orange pill his colleagues, and he would ask them about inflation, they would say, well, why do I care if the prices go up at the grocery store? Because my salary's been going up, mm-hmm. right? And so that ignores the fact that any money that you acquired before will lose its purchasing power over time. So this punishes savers. So if you save, even if your future income increases apace, the previous money that you earned before and saved is now worth less and less over time.
Right. The way I've argued that or kind of tried to lay that out is, you know, I'll say to like someone who's like a teacher, and I'll be like, if you're retired now, and let's say when you were working 20 years ago, you made $50,000 a year and you saved for 10 years, you saved $5,000 a year. And you were like, one day I'm going to have 50, you know, after 10 years, I'm going to have a free year to live and do whatever I want. You know, and 20, 30 years go by and they're retired and you're like, yeah, that 50 grand is going to go half the distance or a third of the distance you thought it was. And now a brand new teacher is making $67,000 a year. And then that teacher has no skills. And they're making more than you. And then you start thinking like, why would the employer be paying more for a worker who brings less to the job? And it just kind of boggles the mind. But everyone, I think, kind of feels that, you know, they're getting by and they're getting their raise. And so how do you think this incentivizes bad behavior?
Yeah. Yeah. So when you have a system where your money loses value over time, one consequence of that is that debts denominated in the old unit, as the unit devalues, debts become easier to pay off. So if you take out a loan for, say, $100,000, and you know that the money is going to become worth less over time, then you can pay it off easier because dollars are easier to come across in the future. As a result of this, it incentivizes debt. You are incentivized to take debt because debts are easier to pay off in the future. The problem with that is that even if you're an honest business person and you would prefer not to take out debt, you mm-hmm. have to compete in a marketplace against other people who will. So despite the fact that you might have personal preference not to take out debt, the only way to survive against your do so. So it requires everybody to take out debt, and then everybody becomes dependent on the money devaluing because they've now assumed a position that requires it.
Right. So kind of like maybe misallocates resources and fuels debt culture. So it's like, how do we, you know, kind of exit that system, you know, and use our kind of our voice to do so?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I made reference to voice and exit. You know, you can complain about things, and ultimately, if it doesn't work, you can let it go. And that's what Bitcoin affords, is an opportunity to not participate in a system that will continuously devalue.
Right. I loved one of your quotes in the book, opposing fiat currency and price inflation. Green paper bad is not a right wing or left wing issue. It's an articulation of a simple truth. Fiat currency is bad money, and everybody knows it. People know it, but they don't see another way, is kind of how I think of it. Is they intuitively know it's not good, but I don't think, I think a lot of people just feel that it's intuitive that there's no other way. You know, it's like the fish in water. But, you know, I think we both agree, you know, we need better money. But, you know, what are like one of the key characteristics of human behavior that like kind of like causes us to need money at all?
Yep. Yeah. So thanks. That's an interesting point. So chapter 2 of my book is called, you know, because we need good money. The question being like, why do we need Bitcoin? I go into in that chapter what makes human cooperation different than cooperation that exists in other species and amongst other species. Money is a way of encoding a debt obligation. It's a way of specifying like something is owed and somebody else. So whereas you might write an IOU that specifies who owes, money is a, what's the word? It's a separated debt obligation. When you give money to somebody, a debt obligation is cleared. And so it's a way of communicating value. It's a way of communicating obligations across time and distance, you know, without maintaining a specific ledger of who owes who what. So that ability to express value and transport it across time and space allows us to cooperate and collaborate in ways that we wouldn't otherwise be able to do.
Right. It seemed like there was a really good discussion in your book about cheating and sort of reciprocity and that sort of push and pull over human history. How have humans kind of like dealt with cheating?
That's a good point. The way that chapter starts off is I describe this work by a scientist named Trivers, who hypothesized that what he called reciprocal altruism, or we might call reciprocal investment, could be evolutionarily stable. This is a trait of a species where one member of a species helps another species and you might say, well, why would you do that from a purely survival of the fittest perspective? Like, well, how does it help me if I help you to live better? And Trivers hypothesized that would work as long as the cost that you pay to help somebody else is less than that they get. And if other people feel that they should also reciprocate or initiate those kinds of reciprocal altruistic activities, then over time, the whole species is better off, that it could be evolutionarily stable. Evolutionarily stable just means that it's a trait that wouldn't cause, it would persist. It would be adaptive to acknowledge. So reciprocal altruism, the willingness to initiate a beneficial act towards somebody else, is an evolutionarily stable activity. But the problem is, if you do it and your potential partners don't reciprocate, they don't also provide investment behavior, then you have a situation where you might be outcompeted in the species. So a species that has reciprocal altruism, like humans, we need a way to keep people in line. We need people to pay their debts. They need to kind of make good on if somebody else does something nice. And so the way this shows up emotionally is when somebody does something nice for you, you feel like you should do something back, right? Somebody gives you a gift and you feel like, oh, I should give them a gift, right? I should do something back. It's called reciprocity. And in the book, I mentioned how it's written about in a couple of different contexts. One is Jonathan Haidt's Moral Foundations Framework, which I strongly recommend. It's a great way, in my opinion, to understand human behavior. Another one is Robert Cialdini's book, Influence. He cites reciprocity as a strong feature of behavior that you can count on. So people feel like they should reciprocate, and then you need ways of policing, basically, like detecting cheaters and then making sure that they stay in line.
This angle into human behavior, was this an interest of yours and some of this literature that you read before Bitcoin or since or both?
Yeah, that's a great question. So to step back a little bit from the book proper, my background is software engineering. As a kid, I never really understood people. People were a mystery to me. They didn't make a lot of sense. But when I discovered computers, they were me. I could make computers do what I wanted. So that became my career. And then, maybe 10 years ago, I realized that, I really should understand money better because money seemed to be important. So I studied that for a while. And then once I felt like I had money understood,
I'm sorry to interrupt, but that's pre-Bitcoin at this point, 10 years ago. I'm assuming that you're looking at money pre-Bitcoin. Bitcoin exists, but you're looking at money.
Yeah, I want to say that my introduction to studying money was pre-financial crisis. So I read I read G. Edward Griffin's The Creature from Jekyll Island circa 2007.
Okay.
So I was already prepared for the financial crisis when it occurred in terms of understanding the
Fed
and its, yeah.
Yeah, awesome.
Well, so all of that is just more evidence that I clearly wasn't smart enough to pick up on Bitcoin earlier. Like I had all the right training and didn't pick up on it soon enough.
Or it's just the right time, I mean, it all lays out the way it does for a reason. And maybe if you didn't have any of those experiences, it wouldn't have played out the way it did at all. But I'm interested. I mean, I've always been interested in money. And actually, I was really looking at the financial crisis before it happened as well. But it's just interesting to talk about people's kind of nerding out on money, because back then there was no one to talk to about it, except maybe your parents or your brothers or your best friend or something. It wasn't like you go to a party or meet up, maybe. There wasn't a lot of meetups on checking and savings accounts.
It was definitely a lonely time. It is interesting in Bitcoin times that you can meet people from all kinds of different walks of life who are now interested in things like monetary policy. But to answer your question from a few minutes ago, with regards to studying people, I have been studying human behavior, reading about that for a similar number of years, although that really ramped up probably 5 years ago. I've read, it's not part of my day job per se, but I studied a lot of those things just on my own.
And how much do you think that plays into your understanding of Bitcoin?
That I think is my, I think that if I was going to categorize my contribution to understanding Bitcoin, it would be on the side of human behavior. I think that as I point out in the book, right, Bitcoin is three things. It's a programmable money. So that's like the monetary side. It's a computer network. So that's the technology side. And it's a social phenomenon. And that's like the understanding people side. And so I think that Bitcoin appeals to a certain category of folks based on its technological achievements. I think it appeals to a certain number of folks based on its monetary properties. And I think that understanding how to frame Bitcoin so that more people are comfortable onboarding is a question of understanding people. That's where I think I can make a contribution.
Yeah, I think you exceeded those things. Exceeded those things, I said. So let's get into it a little bit. Let's get to some of the fun stuff.
Sure.
Let's get down the rabbit hole a bit and kind of turn our thoughts more to Bitcoin. The first thing I'll say is, what is Bitcoin? I don't ask it enough.
I think the answer to that question is it depends on who you ask. And I put out a tweet not too long ago, although I don't have it in front of me. So if you ask me the exact sequence of numbers, I'll probably fail. But for almost everybody, Bitcoin, the first time they hear about it, they say, well, that's a scam. And I'm no exception to that, right? When I heard about Bitcoin in circa 2011, I was like, that sounds like a scam, right? And I never read the white paper as a result. Then you hear it about it again, and it's usually after the price recently crashed, and you're like, well, even if it wasn't a scam, it was a bubble, and I missed out. I'm too late. So then some time goes by and then you hear it about it again and you're like, well, maybe there is something to this. So then people say, well, maybe this is a gamble. I can gamble on this thing, or maybe it's a hedge, or maybe it's an investment, or maybe it's a, as you mentioned earlier, a savings technology, right? Or a store of value. You have all these different ways of framing it. So like I said, in the book, I frame it as three things that are mutually reinforcing and inseparable. It is a programmable money. That is, it's a ledger that has rules for how you can move money around, and you can program those rules. And I can talk about that if you want. It's a computer network by people in order to maintain the cohesiveness and the correctness of that ledger. And then, of course, it is the people who run all those nodes. You can copy the data. The data is public, right? It's easy to copy all the data. I have a copy. I have several copies. Everybody can have a copy, and you could fork the chain and make it do different things if you want to. And people have done that. You can spin up your own nodes. So, you know, you could get an account with AWS or Microsoft Azure and set up a whole bunch of nodes to do whatever you want. You can copy the code, you can copy the ledger, but the thing you can't copy is the people. The people of Bitcoin are ultimately what give it value. Value is always and everywhere a subjective appraisal. And so when people say Bitcoin's not backed by anything, that's not actually correct. Bitcoin is backed by Bitcoiners. It's the people who imbue the project with value.
Yeah, so like that goes along the lines of like, you know, how can a purely digital money, you know, that's not backed by anything at all have a value? And I think it's because of the people. And you kind of have a really good, I think, understanding of the community. What is the perspective of a hodler?
Oh yeah, that's great. The person who hodls Bitcoin, which I pronounce that way, despite the fact that people will argue that to be pronounced hodler.
Sure, I'm still with you. I say hodl.
Yeah. Well, but maybe I'll
accept both. I don't care. That's the thing. This goes to anything. You can call it whatever you want. As long as we understand what we're talking about. Anyone could say what they want, but I go with hodl, but I don't, you know, either way.
Well, yeah. That's the nature of language. People get upset about words like irregardless, mm-hmm. You know, it's like, oh, well, irregardless isn't a word. Yeah. But you knew what I meant.
Is it a word? Is irregardless a word?
Well, see, that's the question, right? What does it mean to be a word, right?
Mm.
Who decides, right? Sure. Language is what people make of it.
Right. That one's a fight in my household. That's why I ask.
One of my favorite words to argue about is literally, right?
So yeah.
Literally, you know, people think, oh, well, people say figuratively when they mean figuratively when they say literally.
Yeah.
Oh, really literally means actually. But right. I like to use literally when it means literary, like something that was written, like literally.
Okay. People are like, he literally got his head knocked off. And you're like, no, he didn't. Like he literally did not get his head knocked off. Maybe figuratively, yeah. Right. So back to the hodler.
Oh yeah, yeah. Sorry.
No worries.
Yeah. So hodlers are an important component of the Bitcoin social sphere. Hodlers hold Bitcoin. They behave as though they accept the basic premise of my book, which is that Bitcoin will become the way we measure all other value. It'll become the thing against which all other opportunities have to justify themselves. And so hodlers effectively are the ones who give the whole project value. They're the ones who are willing to hold it. I was listening to another podcast, which unfortunately I can't remember the name of, and they were anti-Bitcoiners, you know, no coiners arguing, some kind of economics podcast. And the one guy says, well, I have some Bitcoin. And, you know, these guys are, these hodlers are crazy, you know, they'll never sell. And that's why I have some, because they're never going to sell it. And I'm sitting there thinking like, that is the definition of money. The definition of money is the thing you hold because other people will accept it, right? So in all of their ranting about Bitcoin, then they acknowledge that it is the finest form of money ever conceived.
They made a case for it. It's like, knock, knock, who's going to tell them? You know, so without getting into kind of all the social dynamics of researchers, developers, miners, traders, and merchants, but like maybe what are some of the intergroup dynamics between them?
Oh, yeah, that's great. So... in the book, I list a bunch of different groups, you know, including miners, including hodlers, including traders, and they interact in different ways. You know, the miners secure the network; they work on behalf of the node operators, the people who operate nodes, which tend to be hodlers. People who hodl Bitcoin run their own nodes to make sure that The system follows their rules. If you're a hodler listening to this and you don't run your own node, you should be running your own node. It's not that hard to do. There's lots of different options available. But anyway, so the miners work on work for the hodlers, securing the network, and the hodlers buy the Bitcoin that the miners produce. Traders try to eke out a profit by buying and selling, and sometimes get wrecked doing so. But by creating a market for those things, they also facilitate price discovery. So it's a complex, interconnected system, and it's one of the things that makes me so bullish about Bitcoin over almost any time scale, is the way in which those groups of people fragment and change. So, for example, if you're a miner and you want to run a mining farm, you have to get custom hardware. But you don't have to get just custom hardware. You also have to get custom software to run your miners. So the software that runs on the miners and the way that you coordinate your mining pool is different than the code that a hodler runs just validating their own node. They might still run Bitcoin Core, but there's also like miner coordination software that has to get run, and there's various different vendors of that. So over time, what you see is, so hardware wallets have been around for, the stuff that I'm now saying is actually not in Orange Coin Good. It'll be in the next book. It'll be in the next book in the series.
Awesome.
But just like there's mining hardware, there's also hardware wallets. And now over the last year or two, you've seen more and more packages come out for running your own node and pre-built nodes, computers that are ready to go. So you actually have hardware emerging. So when Bitcoin first started off, it was just one software application that you ran on one computer and it mined on regular CPU. And then over time, it just has expanded and differentiated. And the people in that space have also differentiated. And that whole differentiation process, both amongst hardware, software, and people, is part of what I think makes the system so so robust and interesting.
Yeah. I'm curious, how many hodlers, and I'm talking percentage wise and just, back of the envelope math, rough guess, do you think are actually running full nodes?
That is a great question. So I know that Luke Dash Jr. has a dashboard where he has estimates of that. I'm sure that it's tens of thousands.
Do you think that's a small percentage of hodlers and or bigger bucket of anyone who has Satoshis? Or is it like, and what I'm really getting at here, do you think it's a vulnerability that if there aren't more full nodes being run?
Yeah, I mean, we can talk about vulnerabilities.
No, I don't want to go too deep there. I was just curious. I don't want to go too deep into vulnerabilities right now, but I was curious, like, do we have enough people running nodes, and is that a concern of yours?
It's not a concern of mine right now. I think that it's important that the only node that really matters is the one that you run yourself, the one that you use to validate your own incoming Bitcoin. If you're sitting there thinking like, well, I don't have my own node, but there's enough nodes, therefore I'm protected, then you're going about it the wrong way. Because the whole point of this system, and the whole thing that makes Bitcoin different than the legacy financial system, is that you can run your own node. You can't run your own gold full node, right? It's just too expensive. You're not going to smelt coins and then like recast them, right? How do you assert that the gold is really in there? You can't. You can't run your own central bank full node, but you can run your own Bitcoin node, right? That's what makes the system different. If you're going to just trust other people to do stuff, well, we have systems to do that already. Like, you don't need Bitcoin.
Yeah. We're going to turn to part two of the book, and that's more like kind of the how to. And what I love about this is twofold. One, how you kind of compare working with Bitcoin to working with the internet in the 1990s. And I want to dwell on that for a little bit, just that analogy. I just love playing with that analogy. And you get to the, and also how it works, like kind of like email. So we can kind of gloss over, like, gloss not being the right word, but setting up your first wallet, receiving your first Bitcoin, securing your Bitcoin, more with this one table that you have. And I kind of want to just run through this a bit, because it really hits home in terms of how to talk about Bitcoin. So just in terms of like the network, I think of Bitcoin more like working with maybe almost like email in the 70s in terms of evolution. I think that's what you're getting at with terms of user interface. But the reason I say that is that I think that Bitcoin is such in its infancy, you know, because you didn't start using email to 95, 99, 2005. And that, like, you know, if you tried to explain email to someone in the 70s or 80s, they would just be like, let's just stick with the fax machines and the phones. And it would be really hard to convey. But what I love about how the main part of the book is how you walk it through, like, dude, you're just setting up an email account.
Yeah. Yeah. So the middle three chapters of the book in part two. So part two is called How Bitcoin Works for You. And chapters five, six, and seven discuss, you know, setting up your first Bitcoin wallet and how to receive some Bitcoin and then how to manage your keys at a high level. I don't want to scare people off, but at a high level.
Sorry. Yeah, go ahead. No, you go ahead, please. Sorry.
Oh, that's right. So I was just going to say credit where it's due. I first heard of the email analogy from Andreas Antonopoulos. Mm. So he said, you know, he was in this particular talk. He was saying that people will say, well, Bitcoin's really hard to use. And he says, well, so was email when it first came out. It was very hard to use. And you had to telnet into an SMTP server and issue commands over telnet. And that was very difficult. But now it's just a one swipe operation on your iPad, right? And so credit where due, he came up with that analogy. When I was trying to write these chapters to explain to pre-coiners how Bitcoin works, I initially started by thinking of it in terms of a check, like you're writing a check to somebody in order to transfer value. But I got away from that because, well, first of all, who writes checks anymore?
You touch on it a little bit in the book. I do like that one too, because in just in terms of a bearer asset.
Yeah, it's not a bad way to go. But so as far as the email goes, I really just tried to break out. If you were trying to explain to somebody using email for the first time and they don't know anything about email, there's a lot of steps involved that you might not realize are there. The first thing you have to do is find an email provider. And then you have to like get an email client, which might be a website or it might be an application you have to download. And then after you have your provider and your application, you need to set up some kind of a password so you can get into your system. Then when you want to go to receive email from somebody, they have to get your email address. So you need some way to send them your email address that you can receive email from. And then finally, now that they have your address, then they can compose an email, then they can send it off to a server, which relays it to you, and then you can receive the email. So there's really like a lot of meticulous steps involved in receiving email that we forget about because it's so common nowadays. And so in chapters five and six, I make an analogy to each of those nine steps, Bitcoin, so that somebody can say, okay, while it seems very complex getting Bitcoin, it's only complex in the same way that getting email is complex, and it would become simple over time.
Right. And you make some decisions along the way, like what kind of service provider I want. So it's like that's, you know, picking a wallet, you know, the picking a good password is the same thing as generating the random seed, recording your password in a safe place for emails, you know, same thing as kind of taking care of your seed password in Bitcoin. You want to find, you know, you want to generate a Bitcoin address. That's like choosing your email address. Is it going to be your first and last name or is it going to be anonymous? You know, and then now you want to receive an email. So you tell your people, you know, your email address, which is the same thing in Bitcoin. You have your Bitcoin address and you want to compose a message in an email. Well, it's the same thing in Bitcoin. You want to compose a transaction. You want to send, you know, now you want to send out that email. So you send it to the server. Same thing in Bitcoin. You send out your transaction to the network. And so on. You receive the email, and you know the other person receives the email, and it's the same thing as, you know, the other person receiving your Bitcoin or Satoshis in their wallet. And I think that's really great for pre-coiners. It's just a fantastic analogy, and it's one that like I really can wrap my head around. You know, even 4 years in the game, I could still kind of go to that to understand it for myself.
Yeah, well, thanks. I really appreciate that. I think it worked out pretty well. And, you know, I have to credit my my reviewers. So as I mentioned, the book has been through many, many revisions. And coming up with that analogy and explaining it the way that I do is a direct result of some of the feedback from some of the pre-coiners who read the book and told me that things did or didn't make sense to them.
Yeah.
So that's directly where that came from.
Touching on that too, what I love about everyone's contributions is, you know, you took an idea from Andreas and took it further or distilled it or just wrote it down, you know, and then taking a conglomeration of all these ideas and putting your own, you know, expertise and wealth of knowledge on that lens. You know, the same way maybe Brandon Quidham takes the fourth turning and puts the Bitcoin lens on it, or the same thing he did with mycelium and put the Bitcoin lens on it. And to me, that's really fascinating because I love learning through the Bitcoin lens. And so it makes me, I enjoy learning about different topics through that lens. I'll go different places than I normally would, or even further if I can kind of have that bent on it. So I really appreciate like what I think, that's why I think it went, I thought you'd been even further in 2017, because there's been a lot of good things here distilled. So kind of, you know, and while we're talking about, you know, who helped you with the book, I noticed in the acknowledgements before I forget, My Living Truth was someone you gave a shout out to. He's been on the show, episode number 3. So I definitely wanted to, if I forgot, I wanted to give him a shout out. But, you know, so like, you know, I want to turn to like, what does Bitcoin achieve? You know, and you kind of get into some really good principles here that, again, I don't know where you distilled them from or if they're your own, but I like the angle.
Yeah. I'm happy to give credit anytime I can. I do have meticulous notes and references. There's like 20 pages of notes and references, which I assume no one's ever going to read. But I do, to the degree that I can give credit to everything everything I can.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fountain hose out there, not just in Bitcoin. I mean, myself personally, like one of my favorite pieces in 2019 was Gigi's Proof of Life. And it just was in my mind. And really at the forefront, but I had forgotten completely who wrote it, if I even read it. The thought was in my mind. And my first 20 episodes, I kind of like dig at that a bit. And it wasn't until recently on Twitter that I put up a quote that I had taken a picture of in my phone a year ago. I didn't know where the picture was from. And Gigi commented on it and he's like, that's in my piece. And I'm like, whoa, that's where I got the picture from. I didn't link it myself. You know, and yet it was an important piece of not my thinking, but his thinking that I've taken to my own. And so it's almost impossible sometimes to know what's been said and who said it and who you're just taking further, or whether, you know, it's co-independent creation. But I do want to talk about some of these things that you talk about, which is like digital rivalry.
Yeah. So thanks. So the final part 3 of the book is about what Bitcoin achieves. And a lot of people in the Bitcoin space talk about Bitcoin's scarcity. And I might as well put that word in scare quotes, because scarcity is one of those things that it's like reciprocity. It's a feeling, right? So just like when somebody gives you a gift, you feel like you owe them something back. Scarcity is a feeling. It's like, I feel like I don't have enough, right? In Bitcoin, it would be like how Michael Saylor put it, the feeling of being chronically short, like you don't have enough. So scarcity is a feeling in the economics literature. So that's like in the psychological literature, scarcity is a feeling of not having enough. In the economics literature, scarcity is basically anything that is not abundant. So breathable air is abundant. It's just everywhere, right? But, you know, McDonald's Big Macs are scarce in the sense that they're not infinitely available. So I tend not to focus on the scarcity of Bitcoin, because either you're talking about an emotion or you're talking about something that is kind of binary. It's either there or it's not. But so to your point,
very interesting.
I tend to focus on different features of money. And the first two that you made reference to, the first one is rivalry, which I can talk about. The second one is excludability.
Yep.
Credit where due, I learned about those from an economist named Ben Powell. He's one of my favorite economists. He wrote a book called The Economics of Immigration, which I think is a fantastic book, and I could shill if you want to know more about it.
Sure.
But anyway, in one of Ben Powell's lectures, he talks about rivalry and excludability, but I can describe those just very briefly. A rival good is one that can only be enjoyed by one person at a time. Something that's non-rival is a good that more than one person can be enjoying at a time. And there are rival goods in both the real economy, sorry, the physical world, and in the digital world. So in the, a rival good in the physical world might be like a pair of pants. If I'm in the pair of pants, somebody else can also be in the pair of pants. But a non-rival good would be something like an amusement park. If I'm at the amusement park, you can also be at the amusement park. Both of us can be enjoying it simultaneously, right? So you can have rival and non-rival. Excludability has to do with whether or not it's practical to keep someone out of the thing. So a pair of pants is both rival and excludable. If I'm in the pants, I can keep you out and we both can't be in there at the same time. It's rival and excludable. The amusement park is non-rival. You and I can both be there, but it is excludable. The owners of Disney World can keep out people they haven't paid, right? So good money, in my opinion, needs to be both rival and excludable in order to function. And I make the argument in the book that Bitcoin is the first and most rival excludable digital good. There's never been anything before Bitcoin that had all of those properties. So for example, if you play a game like World of Warcraft, right, you can earn gold in that, right? There's World of Warcraft gold. And it's rival insofar as if I earn some World of Warcraft gold, you can't also have earned the same World of Warcraft gold. And if I give it to you, I don't have it anymore. So it is rival. But it's not excludable because the Blizzard servers that grant me access to the gold could withdraw my access. So Blizzard is constantly trying to find people who are farming gold or who are selling gold, and they're trying to police their platform. And the fact that they can police their platform, they can backdoor you and take the gold that you've earned, means it's not excludable. I can't exclude Blizzard from taking my World of Warcraft gold because it's their server, right? Mm-hmm. So there have been digital rival goods before, and almost any game that you play, you know, if you play Half-Life 2, you got bullets, right? Those bullets are rival. Like once you shoot the bullets, the zombie has the bullet now, not you, right? So we've had rival digital goods before, but not ones that are rival and excludable in the sense that they can transfer amongst people, but there isn't a backdoor by a third party who can take them. So to me, that is the crucial feature of Bitcoin, is that it's rival and excludable and digital. And then I can continue to talk about the other properties if you want.
Yeah. What is hypothecation?
Yeah. So that word gets thrown around a lot. Rehypothecation. Yep. The way that I understand it is that hypothecation is when you trade effectively a claim on something. So if you take the home is the physical good, but the mortgage on the home is a claim against the home. Mm. And that's like the hypothecation. You're trading a doppelganger of the thing itself. I haven't studied that term well enough to just go off on it right now. But I do talk about a little bit how for example, financial, in money goods, you have the trading of these digital doppelgangers. You have the trading of things that represent real value instead of the thing itself. So with Bitcoin, you have the real actual thing. You have, you know, when you run your own node, when you hold your own keys, the Bitcoin is yours. Now, I mean, we could get into a philosophical discussion about whether or not you quote unquote have Bitcoin because mm-hmm. it's really on the open ledger and all that. But for the purposes of this conversation, suffice it to say that when you have Bitcoin, it's yours and it's digital and it's rival and it's excludable. You don't need to trade a representation thereof. When people talk about investing in gold, you'll hear people talk about investing in gold. They rarely mean real physical gold that you hold yourself. They almost always mean these quote unquote good delivery bars that are vaulted and managed by central parties, because those parties have specialized in that kind of management. So when you buy gold from an ETF, an electronically traded fund, you don't actually have gold. What you have is somebody's IOU for gold, right? And that company has they have an incentive effectively to sell more coupons than they have actual gold, because, right? And that would be hypothecation of a sense.
Yeah. How is Bitcoin compared to gold in terms of rivalry and excludability?
Yeah, that's great. So real physical gold, if you have a real physical gold coin, it is rival. If I have a physical gold coin, you can't also have it. And it is excludable in the sense that it's practical for me to put my gold in a safe that I control that you can't get access to. So just like the amusement park, I can keep you out. So physical gold, an actual physical gold token, is rival and excludable. But if you're not trading real physical gold and instead you're relying on an IOU for gold, the modern equivalent of which would be an ETF, but in prior generations it would be a banknote. But if you're trading an IOU, Is it rival? Well, I guess in the sense that if I have the IOU, you can't also have my particular IOU, but I can't stop the issuer of that IOU from issuing more IOUs than they have gold. So it's not rival. And is it excludable? No, it's not excludable at all, because the central party who manages the IOU could, you know, disclaim mine. They could say, nope, we don't believe your claim anymore, and now it's gone. So it's not excludable, and it's kind of rival.
Right. You know, it's interesting in terms of, you bring up a really fascinating argument just around how all assets, all tradable assets are getting dematerialized, and just kind of the implications there.
Yeah. So the way that I put it, this is not really, this is kind of, I'm going to deviate a little bit from the book in this case. The way that I put it is gold already failed in the 19th century, right? Gold failed to paper. Gold lost to paper. Gold is heavy. It's physical. In order to settle in gold, you have to transport it over distances, and it's expensive to do so. People found it more convenient to trade bank credit for gold, right? Something could trade as good as gold. We hear about the gold standard, right? Which is when these various countries had pegged their currencies to gold. Their currencies were as good as gold. They were paper, but they were represented by gold. The gold standard, as it were, in my opinion, was already gold's failure. Gold had already failed as money during the gold standard because people were not trading gold. They were trading coupons for gold that they believed were tradable on par, which were, as long as not everybody went to go get their gold at the same time. So gold, unfortunately, because it's in the physical world, is not suitable money and hasn't been ever since the telegraph, because information travels faster than you can settle in gold. So as a result of gold's failure to scale in the real world, because it's so expensive to transfer, people transferred credit instead, and credit became money. And it has been since, the late 19th century, at least the 1880s, I want to say. So gold already failed. Money became credit. And everything that people trade, as you point out, and I make reference to in the book, has been dematerialized. We don't trade the material itself. So in the global financial crisis, that came about because people were trading these mortgage-backed securities, which again is a dematerialization. People don't trade actual houses; they trade ownership clauses of houses. They trade these mortgages that are debt instruments against houses. And so everything has been dematerialized for as long as we've had communication that was anything better than real physical delivery by horse. Like it's all been promises. And so that's partly why I think Bitcoin is so hard for people to understand, because it is not a promise. It is the thing itself. And it's the first thing that is the thing itself.
Right? Yeah. I think you call that, like, it gives birth to digital. Bitcoin gave birth to digital rivalry. I thought that was really interesting. Another thing you said about gold, I thought was funny. These asteroids, there are asteroids filled with gold, but there are no asteroids filled with Bitcoin. You brought up a lot of keywords there around just, like, you know, gold failed and money became credit. And then you pivot to the word promises, you know. And so in the book, you mentioned, you know, not only that Bitcoin gave birth to digital rivalry, but that Bitcoin's monetary units, Satoshis or sats, are not promises. And that fiat currency itself is a chain of promises. And in quotes, the edifice of modern finance is a tower of promises stacked on promises. I thought that was really interesting. And I wanted to turn to, you know, you kind of bring up money laundering, and that there are a couple of different ways to money laundering in Bitcoin, if you could touch on that.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So some people will say that, you know, Bitcoin is used for money laundering, and there's a couple of different ways you can go about it. None of the following is recommendations of performing money laundering.
I get it. Yeah.
Standard disclaimer.
Right.
One way that you could do it if you were trying to launder funds is to, you know, buy Bitcoin, perform a transaction, and then somebody else sells the Bitcoin for, you know, money. The currency that they require. In that case, I think it's pretty stupid, because what you've done is you've taken funds that live potential ledger, the you know, fiat currency ledger, and you've bound them up to the permanent ledger of Bitcoin, and then further bound them up on the other side. So you're creating a trail of breadcrumbs for any future investigator to follow. So that's one way to do it. And it is cheaper than traditional money laundering services, as Bloomberg points out. Another way to launder money is if you live in a place where you have cheap enough electricity, it doesn't have to be globally the cheapest, but at least if it's cheap enough, you could mine Bitcoin and pay your electricity bills in money of dubious sources, but you're mining Bitcoin. And so the Bitcoin that you receive from your mining activity is unattached to the money that you spent on the electricity. So you can use Bitcoin mining. And even if Bitcoin mining is lossy, like, you know, suppose you spend, $1,000 on your electric bill and you get $900 worth of Bitcoin, you've lost 10%. That's the cost of doing the money laundering because you spent $1,000 of dubious origin and gotten $900 worth of Bitcoin that is unattached to that $1,000 in any way. There's no way for the network to find out that that's what you did. So I want to say there was at least one case of maybe Brazilians doing that, laundering money in that way.
That's interesting.
And then the third way that you could do money laundering with Bitcoin is to pay a miner for fresh Bitcoin. So you have, let's say you have Bitcoin that has some sort of history of transactions that are black market in the place where you live, and you want to get clean Bitcoin, you can make a transaction that spends the Bitcoin in such a way that the fee goes to the miner, and then give, instead of broadcasting that transaction so that any miner can claim it, you give it to a specific miner and say, this transaction is just for you. That miner then doesn't broadcast that transaction until they mine it into a block. They get the fee for themselves, and then you pay, you know, they pay you back in some other way.
That's fascinating. You know, so like I was saying before, I think the book has a lot of value for more than just pre-coiners. I think some of the way you look at money and the system is not just fascinating, but insightful. Well, I think there's a lot of wisdom in there. But let's turn to where I think the book kind of really melds with your Twitter profile. And because your Twitter is hardcore, you know, Bitcoin. It's not necessarily for noobs. I think that it gets through to noobs, but it's for you know, Bitcoin maxis as well. But at the end of the book, you kind of get into some subjects that are, you know, or the subject that kind of melds those two worlds, which is kind of like, you know, where this is going and how this could be a metric of intersubjective value. So the first thing you say is, you know, it's the hardest money ever conceived. So what can you mean by hard here, though?
Yep. So in monetary terms, the opposite of hard isn't soft like it is in physical, right? People tend to mistake maybe monetary hardness with physical hardness. And that's because in the past, hard monies like gold were physically hard. But that's not really the key here. The key of being hard money is that it's difficult to produce more. So in the tribal communities of North America, for example, wampum, these seashell beads that people traded was hard money because the only place you could make it was near the coast, and a small number of tribes specialized in that creation. So it was hard enough and worked as money until colonists came to industrialize production. But hard money has to do with how difficult it is to introduce new units into circulation. And so when I say that Bitcoin is the hardest money conceived, what I mean to say is that it is more difficult to bring new units into Bitcoin than any other monetary good. There's only ever going to be 21 million, and the issuance of them is strictly limited by every node on the network that enforces the rules. And it comes out at a predictable rate of, you know, 10 minutes per block. So there's never been a money harder than Bitcoin as far as creating more of it. You can bring any amount of additional mining power to bear, and all that happens is you'll have faster blocks for a short time until the difficulty readjustment. Sometimes people will pontificate, well, what if somebody breaks SHA-256 and suddenly it's much easier to produce hash? And I'll say, well, then we'll get faster blocks for a couple, you know, blocks, and then it'll even out, right? The difficulty will adjust, and then it will simply be harder. Yeah.
Yeah. And before we dig into this a little bit, I want to dip back to the beginning of the book. I think it's your preface or your foreword where you have a quote from Bill Buxton. Any technology that is going to have significant impact in the next 10 years is already at least 10 years old. Any technology that is going to have significant impact in the next 5 years is already at least 15 years old and likely still below the radar. Hence, beware of anyone arguing for some new idea that is going to take off in the next 5 years, unless they can trace its history back for 15, Bill Buxton. What are you driving at here by including this particular quote?
That's a great question. Thank you for asking. Couple of things there. One, I read that in an article that Bill Buxton put out. The original article was, I want to say 2008, and then he has a revised version from 2014. He's a user interface expert in, you know, human computer interaction. And the article that he wrote that in was talking about the mouse. So for example, mice, like computer mouse, like the little device that we now don't use anymore. Now our computers just use touchpads. But he talks about, in that article, he talks about the history of the mouse and how long that technology was incubating before it eventually became really big. Right. And so people thought it was going to be big, and then it took quite a long time. And then all of a sudden everybody has mice, you know, once Apple and Windows came out, and people started using graphical user interfaces en masse. The reason why I point that out in the book and why I lead off with it is because, you know, as I mentioned, this book is for pre-coiners. The point of this book is to help people who have not made up their mind yet about Bitcoin. If you're already a no-coiner and you've already decided you don't like Bitcoin, then I'm probably not going to persuade you. But if you're open to learning, then you're my audience. And so part of the reason why I led with that quote is to kind of ease people into it. Look, I'm not going to tell you that this thing's going to change everything. I'm not going to just immediately hit you over the head with, this is a revolution of epic proportions. I mean, it is, but I'm not going to hit you with that. Instead, I'm going to say, listen, it's good to be cautious. Let's acknowledge that things take a while to roll out. You know, so people who tell you this thing's going to be really big, you know, you have to be able to trace its history back. And I wanted people to know right up front, the Bitcoin blockchain has already been chugging along for as of 2019, 10 years. So it's already 10 years old. So I just wanted to put that frame in people's mind for the pre-coiner reader to know this is not something brand new. Even though you're hearing about it for the first time, it does have a history and it goes back, you know, quite some years.
Yeah, I'd go further and I'd say this is not only a great book for pre-coiners, but I think this would be my favorite book to give to no coiners. Because I think there is a little bit of a bite to it and some slicing truth and some witty insights. So, you know, turning more towards, you know, the intersubjective value, like what are the different kinds of things that people buy today and how do we measure their value?
Yeah, that's a good point. So in chapter 10 of the book, I make the case, which is very speculative. The rest, the prior nine chapters of the book, are all pretty much descriptions of the world as it is today. Mm. In chapter 10, I say, well, here's a little sneak preview of where I think things are going to go. When I say that Bitcoin will become the metric of intersubjective value, what I mean is it'll be the thing against which all other opportunities have to justify themselves. And so to your question, I lay out what I call the strata of different things people buy. And I separate them out by the degree to which they store or create new value. So for example, one strata that of things people buy is just consumables, things that once you use them, they're done. So you need water to live. You drink water. And once you've drunk the water, it's gone. Like it's used up immediately. Food is the same way. Once you consume the food, it's gone. Some food might store on the shelf for some period of time, but the point is the same. Once you use it, it's all over. Up the scale a little bit from that, you have things that store some amount of value. Things like that would be maybe furniture or a home or a car, right? You use it. And then after you've used it, it's not completely junk immediately. It stores some amount of value and it could be used again. So then you have things that you keep for only their ability to store value. And examples of that would be gold, right? Physical gold you store only because it, you know, has value, or predominantly so. And then beyond that, up the scale, you have things that you buy because you think they will generate more value in the future. Examples of that include equity in companies or maybe a rental property, something that you expect to throw off more income over time. So you have things that totally get used up, things that mostly get used up, things that you expect to, you know, gain some amount of value or at least hold their value. And then you have things that you really expect to gain value. And then we use different metrics to judge each of those things. So in the US, we tend to use dollars to measure from the bottom of the scale, you know, things that you consume, all the way up to like gold per se. But then as you get higher up in the scale, there are different rates that become meaningful. So for example, if you're going to buy a debt instrument of some kind, like a corporate bond, there's what's called the risk-free rate, which is kind of a misnomer because there's no such thing as no risk. Like risk is endemic. It's always there. But the risk-free rate is typically referred to in many places, they refer to the treasury, you know, treasury security rate, the government debt as being the risk-free rate. And then you don't judge other bonds against purely dollars, purely holding dollars. You say, how much does this return relative to what I could get if I chose to invest in the risk-free rate, the risk-free rate of return? And then as you go higher up the scale, like you say, well, I'm thinking about investing in a particular stock, say, let's say you like Tesla and you're thinking about buying Tesla stock. You might not even use the risk-free rate as your alternative. You might say, well, my alternative to buying Tesla isn't really the risk-free rate. It might be the S&P 500 because if I wasn't buying Tesla, I would be in some other equivalent because I'm trying to outgrow the market in that case. So the market becomes my benchmark that I compare against. So we have these variety of different things we use as our benchmarks. In some countries, they don't use the local currency all the way up the scale from the bottom. So for example, in Argentina, which has a history of rampant inflation and some other Latin American countries, they'll use local pesos for their lowest level of consumable goods. But then as you go up the scale into, say, cars or apartments, now things are denominated in dollars because it would change too rapidly using pesos, right? So depending on where you are and depending on what you're considering acquiring, the unit that you use to measure the value of the thing that you're buying is different in different cases.
Yeah. So do you think like finance benchmarks will be couched as, you know, in Bitcoin in the future?
Yeah. So right at the end of the book, I make the claim that in the Bitcoin future, the risk-free rate is zero in Bitcoin terms. Mm-hmm. Right? So you can just hold your own keys and that Bitcoin is yours. And zero in Bitcoin terms is the risk-free rate, right? We can talk about what that would equate to in a saturated world against, say, fiat currency. But in Bitcoin terms, just holding your keys, zero is the risk-free rate, the closest to risk-free. There's obviously still risk of theft and risk of loss for your keys. At the lowest end of the spectrum, people might still, to the degree that states continue to demand people pay their taxes in fiat currency, people might still use fiat currency to denote their kind of day-to-day expenses. But as you go up the scale, because Bitcoin is the hardest money and I expect it to continue to take over mindshare, people will start measuring in Bitcoin. And then at the very peak of the scale, you might still have industry benchmarks. So in a post-hyper-Bitcoinization world, people will still invest, but the question of what kind of return you're looking for will be, how is this going to return to me more than the Bitcoin that I put in? If I'm investing Bitcoin, I want a return of positive Bitcoin out. And then different industries might have different risk return profiles, that you would still use as a benchmark, you know. But for the vast majority of things in between, I believe that Bitcoin, the opportunity cost of any investment opportunity, the cost is I could have just held the sats. And so whatever it is that you're offering me as an investment vehicle has to be better than just holding the sats.
Right. To quote you back to you, in short, Jimbo predicts that at saturation, Bitcoin will become a global metric of intersubjective value. Everything that can be measured in sats will come to be measured in sats. And he predicts that the opportunity cost of not holding Bitcoin will be the measure of the value of other things. Kind of turning more towards the rest of the Bitcoin journey. You know, how do we know Bitcoin is just not going to disappear on us?
That's a great question. So zooming out a little bit, as I mentioned, I'm planning on writing a four-part book series. The first book, which we're currently discussing, is called Orange Coin Good. And the question at the heart of that book is, how can a purely digital money that's not backed by anything have any value at all? And I try to explain to the reader about how Bitcoiners provide value, how it is that humans, through reciprocity and through other aspects of human behavior, have a desire for hard money and why it's good and all that. So how can a purely digital money have any value at all is Orange Coin Good. The second book in the series, Bitcoin, Not Shitcoin, is how do you know it won't just, they're all going to be three word meme titles. It's Orange Coin Good, Bitcoin, Not Shitcoin, Number Go Up, and Bitcoin Fixes This. But in the second book, then I'll talk about how do you know it won't just go away or be supplanted by something else. In that book, I plan to talk about central bank digital currencies, altcoins, you know, fiat currencies, kind of all those things. And then we'll also get into the strength of the Bitcoin network at every level and how it compares to some of those other things. Also talk about the regulation.
Another quote of yours I strongly agree with is the best way to learn how Bitcoin works for you is to try it out yourself. You had a tweet, meme the change you want to see in the world. I think you're great at memes. And I want to turn to, I think, you know, what is going to be, you know, maybe your legacy or one of your greatest memes is kind of like, what happens when Bitcoin turns to $1 million per coin?
Yeah. Thanks for bringing that up. So, as we touched on earlier in today's discussion, I've spent some time studying people. I really wanted to understand people better because they were a mystery to me, and I feel like I've understood people a little better. And one thing that I've observed is that people have unit bias. So unit bias comes out. Somebody new to the space finds out about Bitcoin and they find out about these other altcoins and they say, well, why should I try to buy a small fraction of a Bitcoin? You know, that's whatever, $39,000. What about these ripples? I can buy whole ripples. I can buy, you know, so many whole ripples because they're only whatever, 25 cents or I don't even know what they are anymore. I stopped looking.
Yeah. Who cares?
Who cares? Some kind of shit coin.
Yep.
So people have this unit bias. They want to buy a whole thing. They don't want to buy a part of thing. And I'm subject to this too. As I'm hitting my own stacking goals, I'm trying to hit big round numbers, right? I like big round numbers. They have a certain power. And if you look at Bitcoin price history, it likes big round numbers too, right? It spent a lot of time in the $1,000 range. It spent a lot of time in the $100 range. Like big round numbers have a power over people. So currently the price of Bitcoin today, you know, whatever, it's somewhere between $30,000 and $40,000, 39-ish, something like that. That is beyond the grasp of most people. Most people, I've heard statistics that say that most people can't come up with a few hundred dollars for an emergency if they had to. So the idea of spending $39,000 on imaginary internet money is just a crazy, unimaginable sum of money. And as I said, people don't want to buy fractions of something because they don't get it. Like, it doesn't make sense. People are not good with large numbers, and they're also not good with small numbers. And by small here, I don't mean negative. I mean like 0.00000, like numbers that are very small fractions. So, you know, Bitcoin's crossing an awkward chasm where a whole Bitcoin is unimaginably expensive, but it takes thousands of sats to make a dollar, right? They're too small. It's too small to make sense to people. So what I realized was at $1 million per Bitcoin, that is a cent sat parity. It's the price at $1 million per Bitcoin, a sat is 1 cent. And that's something people can grasp. And so what I predict is that at $1 million per Bitcoin, the mainstream media will all switch to a sat ticker. It won't make sense anymore to quote the Bitcoin price in $1 million. They won't say it's, you know, $1.0567 million. Like, that's ridiculous. Instead, they'll say, well, now it's a penny sat. It's a penny per sat. One, and that's a penny stock. And so at that price, you have the convergence of everybody psychologically. You still have all the hard money advocates. You still have all the Bitcoiners, right? But now you get all the would-be shitcoiners too, because the people who would go and trade shitcoins are now like, well, I can buy whole sats. I can buy hundreds of whole sats, right? So the real epic FOMO moon pump, the crux of the adoption S curve, in my opinion, starts at 1 million and ends at 100 million. Because after dollar sat parity, that's when I think Bitcoin will settle into perpetual, if fiat currency is still a thing at that time, it will settle into a perpetual growth cycle of, you know, some percentage in fiat terms over time. That's what I call saturation.
Yeah. I mean, I think the tweet about it, it kind of blows my mind. I strongly agree with it. And I could really see it going from 1 cent a sat to 2 cent overnight within a 24-hour period. Right. In the back of my wildest predictions, I kind of think between here and 500K, we'll have one or two 1x on an overnight. I mean, not one or two times we will 1x within a 24-hour period. I'm not certain of that. I know nothing about price movement, but I do feel very strongly about this switch from 1 million to 2 million on the overnight when that clicks in. And I don't even know if it's FOMO. I wouldn't describe it as FOMO. It is, but I would describe it as sort of that realization around that whole number. And I think that might be when it's clicking for me now, that's when retail comes back in a way. Even if retail comes back at whatever number, I don't really think retail moves the market between here and a million, in my opinion. I could see the mark. I could see it becoming much more appealing to retail at that price point in a way.
Yeah. yeah. That, like I said, nobody wants to buy, 0.001 of a Bitcoin. Like if that's your first time, it just seems weird. It's like, why would I do that? Right.
Right.
But if you say, well, you can, how would you like to buy a million sats? Like, no, that's something I can get behind. So we're kind of seeing Bitcoiners adopt sats, the standard, in their pitch to their pre-coiner friends and loved ones. And so that helps. But I'm saying, like, once you flip and you hit $1 million, CNBC isn't going to show you a Bitcoin price ticker anymore. They're just going to switch to a sat ticker. And there's nothing between a million and 2 million. It just goes directly from 1 cent to 2 cents.
And it becomes cheap. Right.
Yeah.
Much easier to follow and digest. In terms of maybe like Bitcoin mind share, like, do you think that we're in a bubble on Twitter? Do you think Bitcoin Twitter reaches mainstream Twitter by, maybe all of us tweeting at each other? I'm not sure how much we're getting outside of Bitcoin Twitter and what real Bitcoin mind share is.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's hard to say because I'm deeply embedded in that echo chamber as well. I tend to take a more grassroots approach. I would prefer, if I can convince my friends and loved ones to get in and I can help Bitcoiners craft their message in a way that their friends and loved ones can understand, that's kind of the approach that I take. So whether or not it jumps the fence between Bitcoin Twitter and, everything else Twitter, to me, that's not really where I'm trying to go, because I don't need to convince FinTwit. Like, those people can go do whatever they want. I'm trying to reach the friends and family that we are trying to save during this epic transformation of wealth. Yeah.
Do you think that happens on Twitter and podcasts, or is that really hand to mouth, like with us out in the real life, in the real physical meat space world? Are we the bubble rippling in the real world, or is the digital world having an effect as well?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So, I think it happens slowly. So I'm firmly convinced that everybody goes through similar stages with Bitcoin. The very first time you hear about it, it sounds like a scam. You're like, that sounds like a scam. Digital internet money. That's crazy. Like, doesn't make any sense. And time has to go by between you hearing about it, and you need to hear about it from multiple sources. So like, if you hear a crazy theory from one person, you're like, nah, that's just that weird person. I don't know. That sounds like a crazy theory. But when you hear that same thing from a separate source that you believe to be independent, like they're not related or anything, you hear about something else, that's something that you now pay attention to. Like, the second signal has value and you might act on it. But it doesn't mean that the first signal didn't have value. It just meant that that wasn't enough information. So I try to tell people, Bitcoiners, don't feel bad if you've spent a bunch of time trying to convince your friends and loved ones and they've ignored you. And then suddenly they hear about it on CNBC and now they want to buy Bitcoin. Had you not been talking to them, the CNBC signal would be the first time they heard about it and they'd be rejecting it now. So you're preparing them for hearing about it. So it's really difficult to measure the degree to which people hearing about it across the Twitter divide or hearing about it from their families, their family and friends, are being influenced, because it might take the second or third signal before you finally get over it and do some research.
Right. Do you have a dog in the fight with sats versus bits?
Sats the standard, no bits. Yeah.
Do you think it's going to catch on the way? I think Bitcoin is just whatever the mind share is. I think people understand that word now, and it's like maybe like Xerox or something. Maybe they don't know what it is, but they know it exists. Do you think Satoshis or sats will catch on in the same manner? Or is it so obvious to you because maybe at 1 cent they just do, or do we have a different name for it by then? Or
yeah, at one cent per sat, at $1 million per Bitcoin, it will be totally obvious to everyone that there doesn't need to be any other unit. Like, it's just sats. I don't think we need to make it any more confusing than it already is by introducing more different gradations. Right. Had the bit gradation been more popular from the beginning, then I probably would be on the other side of the argument. And I would say, oh, well, everybody's already using Bits the standard, and therefore we should continue doing that because it's what everybody understands. But we don't live in that world. We live in a world where everybody has been memeing Sats the standard, and that's what everybody gets. So I'm not going to try to rock the boat on that one.
Yeah. You didn't use this word in the book, so maybe it's not even in your framework, but you know, is something like hyper Bitcoinization, you know, something that you think about, or is that just irrelevant? What do you think of that word? And do you have thoughts on if it means something to you, how it plays out?
Yeah. So I guess I tend to think that Bitcoin will follow an S-shaped adoption curve, just like so many other technologies. I know there was a recent article where someone was arguing that it won't be, you know, on a price curve, but you know, now we can talk about log scale or not log scale. I tend to think that 1 cent per sat up to $1 per sat, that is hyper Bitcoinization to me. I suspect that will happen very quickly, from 1 to 100 million per Bitcoin. That's it for me. I mean, it could happen quicker, but that I think is hyper Bitcoinization.
Do you think that happens sometime? If going into the next cycle, it's called halving is one from here. You know, is that happening after the next halving? So between 1 and 2 from here, or is that happening after 2 and 3, or is that just like 3 and up, or we don't even know.
Yeah.
Me being you here.
Yeah. So I'm just as bad at trying to predict any kind of medium term or short term price, Bitcoin price, as anybody else. I mean, I've
so much in price, but like where that kind of S curve happens, where we're in the, you know, the more parabolic part of mass adoption.
That's a great question.
I don't care about price, but
oh, everybody cares about price.
But you know what I mean? Price is reflective of that concept, maybe. But so maybe dollars don't even mean anything or whatever, or, you know, but. Yeah. And I don't even know what that trajectory brings for society, but I don't know when that's coming gradually, then suddenly, you know, gradually could be a long time.
Yeah. So if you require that I can't answer in terms of price, then I don't know, but I can, because to me, they're interchangeable. Like
I don't require that. I didn't want to make you a price predictor. That's
yeah.
I hate
no, that's
that.
Fine. That's fine. The price of Bitcoin is the instantaneous expression of the marginal exchange rate between Bitcoin and some other currency, right? So the marginal trader, the weak hand trader, right? The person who's willing to give it up, right? That's the current price. The current price is the weak hand's price because somebody's selling at that price, right? There's some weak hand out there selling. So the way that I tend to look at it from a hyper Bitcoinization, you know, going all the way, right, is, as I've already explained, I believe that at 1 million, that's liftoff, because at that point we go from, you know, 1 million to 2 million immediately overnight when we switch to sats. So the question is, how do we get from here to there? So in my analyses, one of the frameworks that I looked at Bitcoin price through was Benford's law. So Benford's law is an observation that numbers in nature tend to begin with low digits, right? So imagine you just find some numbers of things in nature, and you just keep track of what the first digit is. The first digit: 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. What Benford observed was that most numbers tend to start with ones, and then comparatively fewer numbers start with twos, and comparatively fewer numbers start with threes, and so on, right? And it's kind of like a power law distribution. So I looked at closing Bitcoin price for all time using CoinDesk's API, and I just mapped it out and said, okay, what would Benford's law predict in terms of number of days that we closed a Bitcoin price with a leading digit of one versus how many we actually did? How many days did we close with a leading digit of two versus how many did we actually close, right? So I was just trying to map to see, to what degree does Bitcoin price follow Benford's law? Just, you know, Benford's law is an observation. It predicts certain things. Let's see how Bitcoin price lines up. Bitcoin price does not exceed Benford's law for 1 and 2. It does exceed it in some of the other digits, which means it's a little bit more flat than what Benford's law would predict. But if you look at the price, what you find is that there is a super abundance of ones. There's a number of, there's more days that end with a Bitcoin price and starting with a one digit than other values. So for example, as I mentioned earlier, there are lots of days that ended with a one. There were a bunch of days where the Bitcoin price was, say, $10 or $100 or $1,000 or $10,000, right? There were a bunch of days where the Bitcoin price ended in the, you know, say 10,000 to 19,000 range. There were comparatively fewer days where the price ended, sorry, where the price began with a two digit, like $2,000, $200, $20, right? Those sorts of things. And comparatively fewer with a three and comparatively fewer with a four. Six is a little bit of an outlier. There were lots of days that had a six leading digit for some reason. So what this tells me is that, and this seems stupid, like why would the leading digit have anything to do with Bitcoin price? Because really what price is supposed to do is be the instantaneous marginal value. But as I said, people have cognitive biases. People are not intensely numerate. People have unit bias, right? People like big round numbers. So people like the big round number of, say, 10,000. Okay. So all I'm trying to say here is that Bitcoin price likes to start with a low first digit. Right now at 39,000, this is not the kind of first digit that Bitcoin likes to have. Bitcoin wants to either, as far as people's psychology goes, it wants to either settle in around 10,000 or it wants to go up to 100,000, but it doesn't want to stay at 39K, right? It doesn't want to be 78K. It wants to be 100,000 or 10,000, right? So the question then for this bull market cycle is, after it passes 100,000, how much further does it go? Does it go far enough to reach escape velocity, in which case it goes into the high hundreds of thousands where it just wants to go directly to a million? Or do we crash back down? So if you look at the previous history of blow-off tops in Bitcoin, the very first one, the big one that shows up in 2012, went to $29. It didn't quite hit $30. It hit 29. Second time was in April of 2013. It went to like $230. Didn't make it all the way to $300. Starting digit was a two. In late 2013, the blow-off top was right around $1,200. First digit was a one, and then it never broke that blow-off top again. Okay, fast forward to 2017, blow-off top, what was it? $19,000. It didn't quite make 20,000, right? And then it crashed, okay? So now here we are, we've broken through the previous all-time high, and we're in this awkward intermediate position of $39,000. The next stop is 100,000. Right? How much further we go past 100,000 is the question for the hyper Bitcoinization question, the tipping point. My viewpoint on this is, if in this particular bull market cycle, we go to 300,000 or higher, we're now in that awkward position where Bitcoin doesn't want to be. It doesn't want to be $300,000. It wants to be $1,000,000 or 100,000, right? And so to your question, do I think that we'll have this tipping point where everybody gets in? I think it's unlikely that we're going to pass $300,000 on this particular halving cycle and then go all the way to a million, which would then, in my opinion, trigger the SAT conversion, which would then take us the rest of the way to the moon, per se. I think it's unlikely, but like I said, I mean, things happen fast. Once everybody, I don't know. So let me just switch gears a little bit. And I'm sorry if you don't want to talk about price. I mean,
no, this is great. I don't like bringing it up and forcing it, but this is wild stuff. I'm enjoying this immensely.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So, I mean, I can point you to, maybe after the call, I can point you to a page where I talk about Benford's law and you can just look at the data. I mean, I made a little chart of it and you can look at it. I don't mean to say that that's perfect. All I'm trying to say is, like, by looking at the first digit, it gives us insight into people's psychology, because ultimately that's what price is. Price is psychology. It's what people feel. It's how do people evaluate Bitcoin at the margin. Right. So to the degree that we look at the price, what we're looking at is how did people feel in the past? And there tends to be gravity towards a low first digit is kind of what I'm saying. But anyway, skipping past that a little bit. So I mentioned earlier, the first time you hear about Bitcoin, it sounds crazy. It sounds like this wild scam. And so you kind of dismiss it. And whoever you heard it from the first time, you can dismiss them too. But once you hear it from the second or third person, that becomes a signal. And this is true of all kinds of things. When you hear about something the first time, it's like, I don't know about that. Second or third time, it's like, okay, well, maybe there's something to it. Okay. So most people know zero Bitcoiners. If you randomly sample from the population of planet Earth, a random person, they probably know zero people in Bitcoin. They probably know zero Bitcoiners. Mathematically, the median number of Bitcoiners that anyone knows is zero, right? For people who know any Bitcoiners, the median number of Bitcoiners they know is one. They know one weirdo, right? And that's it. Okay. Now, Bitcoiners who spend all their time thinking about this stuff, they know many Bitcoiners because they've sought them out, right? Okay. But the random average person probably knows one weirdo. If they know any at all, they probably know zero. When you only know one person who's into something, that's just that guy's weird hobby, right? But once you know two people, that's a potential signal. When you know three people, now you better get on board or you're going to be left behind. So this is where the gradually then suddenly comes into play. We're in the gradually phase where we're picking up kind of people one at a time. We're picking up the crazy weirdos one at a time. People get attracted by the price going up, and then sometimes they stay in and they do the more research, right? But a lot of people boil off and then later they come back in. But once people know two or three other people who are into Bitcoin, it will all happen very quickly. I tend to think that that will happen around the same time that we hit $1 million for Bitcoin, because that will also trigger a whole bunch of people saying, this is a penny stock and now I can get into it. Whether or not those two things happen at the same time is hard to say.
Yeah. That was probably my favorite conversation about price I've had in a long time.
Okay.
Because I'm a bulltard, but I try not to really talk about it because I don't want to sound like one. I don't want to sound like a fool on the corner. And I want to bring a lot more, you know, to the table than just talking about price, because that's kind of easy. But that was fascinating because we're talking about the psychology of numbers and what kind of drives human valuation. And it was really interesting how the way you described it, where it was like, Bitcoin doesn't want to be at this in-between awkward phase. And I think we all sense that. And we all know it's like, you know, like we're at 38,000, wherever we are. It's like, yeah, I feel like, and I never know what we're going to do over the short term, but I feel like, and I'm always wrong in the short term, but, you know, we're going to go up 50% or down 50% from here, because we're testing sort of, you know, 10,000 to 100,000. And I believe very strongly where we're going, and that's up. But like the path there sometimes is painful, you know, and shakes people off and things like that. But I thought that was really interesting. I kind of want to pivot a little bit to, you know, like, and again, labels here are just really a crutch. You know, they're not what you are or, you know, anything like that. But like, do you consider yourself something like an anarchist, you know, an anarcho-capitalist?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. So, I was kind of, that I was born a libertarian. And the reason why I say that is because I remember in high school, we were learning about the political parties, which have changed somewhat since when I was a kid, but we were learning about the Democrats and the Republicans. And the teacher explained, well, you know, the Democrats want a liberal social policy, but then they want restrictions on economic policy. This was true when I was in high school. It might not be now. And the Republicans, well, they really want, a strong restrictions on your social dynamics, because at the time it was aligned with Christian values. But they want liberal economic policy. And I remember saying to one of my colleagues in high school, that's weird that there's not a morally consistent party. He's like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, why isn't there a party that's like, social liberal and economic liberal, like let people do what they want in both realms? And he's like, well, there is, it's called the libertarians, right? So I kind of was that before I knew what it was. In falling down the rabbit hole in 2017, I ended up reading a lot of things. And part of what I read was Rothbard. And so I did like his description of anarcho-capitalism. The problem with anarcho-capitalism, and here we get into psychology again, is that it is made from two words that trigger a lot of people. It's made from the word anarchy, which people equate with chaos. And it is used as the word capitalism, which a lot of people equate with exploitation, right? And it also just sounds bad. I mean, it's got like these really hard, like anarcho-capitalism. It's just got all this like anger in its way it's speaking. So I believe that anarcho-capitalism is a correct philosophy in terms of maximizing human wealth and outcomes and maximizing happiness. But it just sounds terrible and it triggers people because of its history and the words that it uses. So the label that I've picked for myself is consensualist. And so consensualism is the idea that interactions between people should be consensual or not occur, right? Everybody should consent, right, to whatever's going to happen. And if they don't consent, then it doesn't happen, right? I picked this word because I mean it to be inarguable. You don't want to be on the other side of pro-consent. Like you don't want to have to defend like, well, no, sometimes it's okay not to require consent. Like really, when is that, right? You sound like an asshole. So I picked the word consensualist for that reason, for the mimetic quality. So consensualism is a rebranding of anarcho-capitalism and just a slight tweak in focus. Anarcho-capitalism tends to focus very heavily on the individual. Like, what are the individual's rights? What are my rights as an individual? And how does my rights interact with somebody else's rights, right? That's kind of like the anarcho-capitalist frame. And that's all great, except that human beings are not purely individuals in a Hobbesian jungle. Like, you're not living by yourself on an island. There are other people, right? So the postmodernist angle is to frame everything in terms of groups. Well, what group are you a membership of? And then how is that group competing with other groups? And how do they struggle for power? And so rather than focus on either the individual, like the anarcho-capitalists do, or the group label, which is what the postmodernists tend to focus on, I take the middle ground. So the middle ground is that the atomic unit of ethical inquiry is the bilateral relationship between two people, right? Between two people, there's a relationship. And the way that I try to explain this is a marriage has properties that are not reducible to either of the partners in the marriage, right? Like, one person is a person, another person is a person, they have a marriage, and that marriage has properties that cannot be reduced further. It requires both people in order to be a marriage, right? And so part of what makes money so difficult for people to understand is that money doesn't make sense for the individual, right? So, you know, famously, Mises' regression theorem tries to reduce everything and say, well, money has to be a commodity because it has to have value to me. Like, I have to be able to have value in this money. And I reject that. And I reject it because money is not for the individual. If you lived alone on an island, you have no need for money. You just don't need it. Money only has value because its primary use case is speculation. I speculate that my money will have value to somebody else. Somebody else will take it, and they will take it for the same reason, because they speculate that somebody else will take it. Money is an emergent property. It arises in the relationships between people. It's not reducible to the individual. So anyway, consensualism is a philosophy which says that in an interaction, people should consent. And if they don't consent, then the action shouldn't happen. And it is anarcho-capitalist in effect, but focuses on the bilateral relationship instead of the individual.
So again, not to have you speak for a whole label,
sure.
But you know, maybe speaking for the consensualists or for yourself, what is your take on 2020?
My take on 2020. Well, it was good for Bitcoin, as all things are. 2020 was interesting. You know, we had the coronavirus, we had a bunch of social unrest, we had some political turnover in the United States. I don't know, lots of things happened in 2020. As far as consensualism is concerned, I don't know. I don't have like a nice packaged response to that question.
Does you know? I'm going to kind of blend consensualism with anarcho-capitalism here, but like, is there like a vision? And again, for yourself, not, you don't have to speak for, you know, a whole quadrant of people or something, but like for where things are going or how things might go better, you know, how maybe consensualism is having a positive effect, or is it not having an effect, but it's kind of like what we were talking about with Bitcoin, where it's gradual. Maybe it's having the effect that it's having, but it's gradually and suddenly, and it just, we go on with our lives and we try to live them, or are we going to get anywhere with consensualism in the next 10 or 20 years?
That's a great question. I don't know, right? So like I said, you want to meme the change that you want to see in the world. I would like to see a change wherein people respect other people's choice about whether to associate and whether to disassociate, right? So let me give an example. One thing that has been argued quite a bit, both in Bitcoin, Twitter, and I'm sure elsewhere, is masks, right? Like, what about masks? Should we all be required to wear masks? Should we not be wearing masks? How should that all play out? The consensualist viewpoint on masks is you're interacting with somebody else. There are two people interacting. If you're by yourself, then wear a mask or don't. Like, you're by yourself, who cares, right? If you're with somebody else, then you and that other person are both there together. And then you both have to agree or not agree, like, to do whatever you're going to do, right? So the consensualist viewpoint on masks is, if you have a grocery store and you want to require people to wear masks, then by all means, like, make that the rule of your grocery store. And if you are a customer of the grocery store and you want to go there, then you wear the mask. If you don't want to wear a mask and they don't want to let you in the mask, then consent has not been achieved and you don't shop there, right? If you're a grocery store or a gym and you don't want to require people to wear masks, then don't. And then people who want to go there will see other people making their choices and then choose to do or not do whatever they want to do. So the consensualist viewpoint on the mask wearing is, you know, you do you and let somebody else do their thing. And when you interact, then choose to interact or not. And both of you have the right, so to speak, not to interact if you don't want to, you know, at your discretion.
Yeah.
That's my point. Yeah.
Yeah, man. Thank you for sharing. And like my kind of final, like just touch point is I do want to, I mean, you took a whole page to say it. So I just want to say, you know, to grandma, thanks for always listening. That was really sweet. And I definitely want to leave it to you for any parting words or anything you want to share and let us know where we could find you and how people can buy the book and give it to pre-coiners and give it to that stubborn no-coiner too.
Well, like I said, I don't know if my book will persuade no-coiners, people who have an entrenched opinion. I don't know. Yeah. Final words. Yeah. I mean, I wish I had prepared better for this question. Thank you for acknowledging my grandma. She does in fact listen a lot. I honed a lot of my arguments talking to her, you know, figuring out analogies that worked for her. Yeah, I don't think I have any, I don't think I have any closing thoughts. Oh yeah. Where can you find me?
Yeah, sorry. Man.
On Twitter coin. I'm also Jimbo Coin on Telegram. Yeah. When I fell into the rabbit hole in 2017, my normie friends made fun of me by creating these custom chocolates that said Jimbo Coin. They held an ICO initial chocolate offering and like gave me the coins. So I adopted that name. So I'm Jimbo Coin on Twitter. I'm Jimbo Coin on Telegram. I'm now Jimbo Coin on the bitcoinhackers.org Mastodon, which I'm working on switching over to from Twitter. And the book is called Orange Coin Good. It's available on Amazon. If you search for Orange Coin Good on, you know, Google or Amazon, I'm sure it'll come up.
Yeah. I'm going to ask us one more question and I'm going to correct myself even. I think I say pleb when it's singular or referred to like maybe myself or someone else. And I don't really think of myself as a pleb, even though I probably am one. But when it's pure plural, I say plebes. And so I'm wondering, have you met any of our fellow plebes from Twitter in real life in the meat space? I'm not looking, you know, you don't have to say where or when or anything, but I'm just wondering if you've met any in real life.
Yeah, I don't think so, although I have run into some in VR. So there's there's a Reckless VR meetup, and I have met a few people in virtual reality.
Yeah, man. Well, this has been so dope. I've really enjoyed this a lot. I really appreciate it, man. And I hope everyone goes out and buys Orange Coin Good. Like I said before, I really think it's, you know, a heck of a book to give to pre-coiners. I think it's got a really unique angle to it that might cut through.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate that. It's very kind words.
Yeah, man. All right. It's been dope. Peace.
Jimbo, laying out the philosophy of consensualism and the intersubjective value of Bitcoin right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And thank you for listening. If you dig the chats, please subscribe, like, and review wherever you dome your pods. Those reviews are the best way to get the word out so I can keep grinding out thought-provoking conversations on Bitcoin. And if you're interested in sponsoring the show or just want to shoot the shit, hit me up. My DMs are always open. This is Cedric. Peace.